You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 90. This minute begins with Shaw asking Wayland, "Save you from what?" and ends with Wayland taking a few shaky steps by himself. Wayland says he needs saving from death, of course, in a matter-of-fact way, and rightly so. It's fascinating to see the current scientific understanding of aging. For a while now, aging has come to be deemed an illness, and one we can reverse. The absolute latest research is very exciting. The real challenge will be social and political, as discussed in the previous episode. Many people have their reservations. For example, some argue that it's unnatural and you would go mad if you lived too long. They used to think you would go mad if you rode in a steam engine that exceeded 20 kilometers per hour. Humans are far more resilient than that. Philosopher Shelley Kagan argues that death is a means to save us from boredom. If we live forever, we would eventually find life unbearably dull. I don't believe that at all. Some people are born apathetic or with anhedonia. Some people are just chronically depressed and bored. Doesn't matter if they're 10 or 10,000 years old. I have a friend like that. She never expected to reach her 20s and is very uncomfortable at the idea of living any longer than she has to. I cannot fathom thinking that way. That's tragic to me. Life is all we have. It's the most precious thing in the universe. I mean, look out there. There's no life as far as we can see. We are very rare and special. And a life can take on endless forms. It needn't be any one thing. Even if you can't change your reality, you can potentially change your mindset. Clearly, I have a very different perspective than my friend. My problems are physical, hers are mental. So I understand why the issue is so controversial. Nothing is more personal than how and when we would prefer to die. By contrast, some people reach their twilight years and are living life to its fullest. They are not sitting around waiting to die. Just look at Ridley Scott. The man is 83 and showing no signs of slowing down. It really depends on the individual and their natural mindset. Hopefully, the longer you live, barring any mental illnesses, the more enlightened and mindful you become. You will learn to be at peace doing nothing but existing in the moment and observing. You will transcend the need for novelty. Sort of tying back into what I said in the last episode, humans no longer need to hunt and gather, but we still have those instincts. And if left unchecked, they can disrupt our lives in the form of excessive eating, drinking, shopping, gambling, just to name a few vices. It's all pressing those primal buttons. But we are sophisticated animals, and we are capable of finding a higher purpose, be that spiritualism, art, science, philosophy, culture, or whatever else. Obviously, it's not a path that everyone wants to take or can take, but it should be an option. What should be made clear is that realistically, true immortality is impossible. We might eradicate age and disease, but you can still die from an endless list of causes, like drowning, burning, and vehicular accidents. Polestats estimates that eliminating age and disease would lead to the average lifespan becoming around 9,000 years. And that's great! That's plenty! Who needs to live longer than the entire pharaonic period of ancient Egypt? That's not a word I get to use often. I tend to make a firm distinction between immortal and invincible. You can be one or the other or both, but they aren't strictly a package deal. Because people tend to use those words interchangeably, they conflate those concepts, and that's where all this confusion comes in. For example, elves and vampires, immortal. They don't age, but they can be killed at any time. Wolverine is practically invincible. He's able to regenerate and heal from any wound, but we also see that he can age, so he's not immortal. But Dr. Manhattan? He's as invincible and immortal as it comes, and no one is arguing for that kind of power. Even me, who's just like, I want to experience all life and everything it has to offer. Even I'd have to really give that some second thoughts if it was offered to me. So let's break down the most common arguments against immortality. Overpopulation. That's the number one argument people throw about. First of all, people in developed countries are having fewer children on average. And theoretically, we're looking to colonize Mars and over a long enough time, other planets too. So we will have plenty of room for everyone. Overpopulation is an issue people bring up now, and the thing is, that's not really the issue we have. The real issue is that we are not distributing our resources equally. So there is plenty of land that we do not use. Some of it is harder to reclaim or terraform. There's a lot of desert. Well, I mean, look at Australia. Most of the interior of my country is empty. It's uninhabited. And so if we were to build cities all throughout Australia, you could house a lot of people. We're also producing more than enough food for everyone. In fact, we're creating a lot of food waste. Again, the problem isn't that we don't have enough, it's that we aren't distributing it equally. So, overpopulation, it's technically a problem, but changing the population itself is not the answer. Second argument, you will lose everyone you ever loved. I mean, let's face it, some kids lose their families before they even hit puberty. Every day might be the last day you have with your loved ones. It's just the price of being alive. People can move on, remarry, make new friends, and so on. If you're eternally young, it makes things easier too. And obviously that's not to say it's not tragic, but it's a part of life whether you're mortal or immortal. I don't see this as a specific argument against immortality. It's just an argument against being alive full stop. That's like the antinatalists, which is the most ridiculous argument I've ever heard. Antinatalists have basically taken philosophy to its extreme without applying it to actual models of reality and science and logic. So antinatalists believe that it is immoral to have children because children cannot consent to be born. And life is nothing but suffering and pain, and why would we inflict that on anyone? And my argument against that is you're assuming that suffering and pain are bad. You are giving it a label instead of simply experiencing it as an aspect of life. Argument 3, the human brain can only store so many memories. Well, yeah, you can be forgetful at any age. It's not like a hard drive that runs out of room. Our brains delete and make new memories all the time. That's why we record our memories. We take photos, keep journals or blogs or vlogs. If I hadn't deleted my cringy Live Journal and DeviantArt accounts, you would have a perfect record of my teen years. These days, archiving our past isn't a huge deal. Personally, I believe what would happen is, well, what happens to us now? Your clearest memories are either the most recent or the activities you did the most often. For example, I do not have a perfect recollection of my primary school years, it's just snapshots. But I certainly remember the buildings and the people, the things I saw every day for 8 years. It's only the memories of the past decade or so that things become more defined. I can remember specific conversations and details and so on. I think part of that is just being an adult and knowing what's going on. Whereas as a kid, it's like, oh yeah, Mum was driving us somewhere. Where were you going? I have no idea. Like, you're not even paying attention to reality. But even then, human memory is pretty pathetic, and that's why eyewitness testimony is not admissible in a court of law, because we like to think we have this perfectly photographic recollection of our past, but it's an illusion. I mean, consciousness is an illusion, but our memories are like a little film or a little story that we've constructed. We are creating a narrative out of what really happened. And there are so many instances, even doing this podcast, where I'll watch the minute of this movie in preparation to write this, and I'll be writing the script or even be recording, and then I'll suddenly be like, hang on, is that detail like this or was it like that? It's all just construction. It is not a perfect record. Some people seem to really believe that it is almost like a computer, that it's just saving all this data and it's flawless. But, I mean, for the longest time, memory did not need to be that sophisticated. It was just, remember where the watering hole is. Remember where that pack of saber-toothed tigers lives. Remember where you left your things. Remember where the good food is. Remember what the poisonous berries look like. You didn't have to remember passwords and phone numbers and dates and, you know, hundreds of people's names and, you know, there was no call for that. Also, not to tangent, but some people honestly believe that your eyeballs, when you're looking, your eyes are not absorbing the light and creating the image, you know, in your brain. No. They think that your eyes kind of scan the world. So like it's shooting out invisible laser beams and scanning like your goddamn Superman. Like, so yeah, it's fascinating to me how people kind of create their own internal logic for their internal functions. My memory is not the best anymore. I used to have a pretty good memory. But, you know, since getting sick, it's just I will forget people I met only relatively recently. I will forget what I'm saying mid-sentence. My brain will just go completely blank. Thankfully, I seem to be pretty good at remembering when I'm supposed to go to appointments and stuff. But, yeah, those other things, not so much. I have to wonder, though, if you have an eidetic memory, a photographic memory. You know, there's people who you could say, what were you doing on the 3rd of February 2009? And they can tell you in complete detail exactly what they did, what they had for breakfast, where they went, who they talked to, what they talked about. It's phenomenal. So, you know, people like that, if they lived for an unnatural length of time, what happens to their memory? Do they start to forget from the sheer fact that there's only so much room in your brain, so you have to rewrite over that space? The truth is, we simply do not know anything about the brain, really. We're just scratching the surface. I think if you were, say, 9,000 years old, your memories of the past century are probably the clearest, and anything further back is less clear, but you probably would know the highlights, you know, World War III, the technological singularity, first contact with aliens, you know, all the greatest hits. The other argument is you will lose all sense of time. And I think this is an absolutely ridiculous argument. You're still tied to a physical body. You need to eat and sleep and have bowel movements at regular intervals. Unless you were a cyborg or a Dr. Manhattan-style superhuman, you would be bound to your human routines. Light is the biggest factor in determining your circadian rhythms. And without it, people do start sleeping and waking at very strange intervals. I'm talking about subjects going 3 days without sleep in a cave, but they thought it had only been about 12 hours. But that has nothing to do with immortality. It's just your circadian rhythms. But could that happen because of immortality? Well, we simply have no evidence to support this one way or the other. But consider this. It's not like elderly people suddenly lose all track of time, other than because of retirement, they simply don't need to remember if it's the weekend or not. I mean, I'm like that. Unless I have an event coming up, I have no idea what day it is. I simply don't need to. The logic behind this argument is that as you get older, each day of your life takes up a smaller fraction of your life. But I argue there is an upper limit to that phenomenon based on your physical needs. There are probably more arguments, but those are the most common ones I can think of. I personally believe in agency and consent above all. I would fight just as hard for the right to euthanasia as I would longevity. All individuals should have the right to choose the length of their life. Obviously, life is full of accidents and unforeseen circumstances, but ideally, if you plan to live for 30 years, or 330 years, or 3,030 years, you have the right to pursue that goal and no one should be able to intervene. I think that is more ethical than withholding these options from people. Obviously, not everyone agrees. Euthanasia is denied in many countries, and on top of that, cannabis and hallucinogens are also illegal, so great job letting people go into the night in peace and dignity there. I have always been really fascinated by the notion of life extension or even immortality. And especially now that I have chronic fatigue, it's more important to me. It's a real issue. I have spent most of the last decade asleep, and really, I've been sick with one thing or another since birth. So to me, it's a very important issue. If you can't cure me, at least give me more time to make up for the time I've lost. So to see antagonists and villains like Wayland and many characters like him, it's a little insulting. And even when we look at characters who are naturally gifted with immortality, this gift or curse is often given to monsters, vampires most notably. Elves might be the one positive example, but they are often aloof or indifferent to the heroes. Actually, I will give The Witcher credit. Geralt and Yennefer are immortal, or at the very least, very long-lived, and it's just a fact of life for them. Never once is it really mentioned as an issue one way or the other. You may have seen the recent Morbius trailer, the new Marvel film starring Jared Leto. He plays a character who has some kind of degenerative disease, and he is on a quest for a cure. As a result, he becomes an immortal vampiric creature. It seems almost like a metaphor for the wealthy draining the blood of the poor to become more powerful. Of course, I can't say too much about a film I haven't seen, but I would be surprised if we are given a nuanced exploration of this issue. And likewise, Prometheus does not give us nuance here either. Be it age or disease, it's horrible. It's scary to be trapped in a body you can't control or recognize anymore, to be robbed of your dignity. I'm a transhumanist through and through. I suppose that is my idea of transcendence. So I generally don't see Wayland as immoral in his goal. It's just the means by which he accomplishes this that is the problem. Although, let's break that down. Does he really do anything terrible? Wayland is a fascinating character to me because he walks that line. He's not a good man. He is selfish, ruthless, without a shred of compassion for anyone else. But so far, all he has done is be a terrible father to Vickers and a terrible creator to David, and even then, we don't know the specifics or the extent of it. He has funded this mission, and he wants to talk to an engineer. So far, okay. And when he meets the engineer, he still doesn't do anything outright evil. He tells the security officer to make Elizabeth shut up. He didn't specify he should hit her. He's just an antagonist, not a villain. He's a self-interested jerk, to the point that I honestly do not think he would care about things like revenge or world domination or anything like that. He just does not care about other people. He's off doing his own thing. He really is not interested in other people either controlling them or anything like that. It's not until we get Weyland-Yutani that the corporation as a whole becomes more nefarious, but as it's presented in Prometheus, the company doesn't seem unethical and seems to be providing a lot of useful technologies to society. Of course, we don't know anything about their business practices, and you know they might be working with slave labor, you know, you don't know. Well, I don't know. They're probably using androids, so they're probably not even abusing their staff. Shaw says she was wrong, that the engineers weren't what they thought they were, and that they must leave. Now, at this point, she still knows nothing about the engineers. She's encountered the mutagen, but not the beings that manufactured it or even handled it. Again, referencing back to an old comparison I used, it would be like an alien showing up on Earth, getting his hands on plutonium or anthrax and concluding that humans must be monsters trying to destroy everything in their path. When she says Charlie is dead, she very pointedly looks at David. She's on to him. But why? What clued her in? Well, the obvious place our minds go to is her previous encounter with David. He wanted to preserve the alien. He seemed to know a lot more than he let on. However, that's quite the leap to think David had anything to do with Holloway's infection. Really, she goes through this entire movie without knowing whether he's a bad guy or not. And that's what sparked people's imagination before Covenant. Who does David become with total freedom and Shaw at his side? We can only glean tidbits from what little we have been told, and it's quite the shame. Wayland is not at all concerned. When told they should leave, Wayland asks Shaw, What would Charlie do now we're so close to answering the most important questions posed by mankind? What surprises me here is that he even bothers to persuade her. Does he still need her? For what? I would have otherwise assumed he would simply say, well, if you want to miss out, go ahead. Stay here on the ship where you'll be safe. If you don't come back, you'll just return to Earth. What do I care? Instead, he is putting in the effort to be persuasive. Is this just his need to be right and in control? I don't get it otherwise, even from the perspective of the needs of the plot. If he had said, fine, stay here, she could still turn around and say, no, I'm going with you. Maybe insert her reasoning here. It works either way. In fact, I think it makes more sense if she does meet a little bit of resistance and she's like, no, I have a right to be there and I should come along with you. Going back to the most important questions premise, Wayland will repeat this in his TED talk and in Covenant. He has long been obsessed with these, if I'm honest here, juvenile philosophical questions. But I think this incongruity comes down to the fact that he is not an atheist, but more accurately an anti-theist or misotheist. There's not exactly a specific term. It's not a position held by many people in the real world. Because to accept that there is a God on faith alone is belief, and belief is worship. Why believe God is evil when you can decide God doesn't exist at all? Most atheists don't even hate the concept of a god. They hate the actions of the worshippers, the intermingling between church and state. I'm using God in the singular for the sake of clarity and convenience, but of course there are many other gods in polytheistic religions. Basically, Wayland is operating from a rare assumption. One I have only otherwise seen in Lord Asriel in his Dark Materials. If you haven't read it or watched it, I won't go into too much detail, but these are men who accept that God exists, but that this God is at best untrustworthy and at worst a villain. And these men live in fantasy worlds where this is in fact true. It really changes the playing field. And this is why I love fiction, because it forces you to consider these hypotheticals. If God was real, you'd be angry, right? You'd have a lot of questions. Why did you make my father abuse me? Why did you give my child cancer? Why did you let my dog get hit by a car? Why? If God isn't powerful enough to have intervened, if God simply created life and that it was the extent of his power, then is he even really a god? Is he even worthy of your worship? If God is real and moreover present, how long before such a relationship becomes hostile? There would be a lot of Waylands and Lord Asriels in the world. Somewhat related, but I have been watching an anime called Black Butler lately. It's all about angels and demons. Season 1 is fantastic, let's pretend season 2 didn't happen. Except, there is one decent episode where this woman is able to kill souls. Just so you not only kills a person physically, but destroys their soul. I found this a disturbing thought. And then I remembered, well, I always assumed there was no afterlife anyway. But within this fictional world, it becomes a deeply unsettling notion. Perhaps because she's robbing someone of something people in our world so desperately wish to believe in. It's like discovering unicorns are real right as the last one dies of old age right in front of you. It's just, that would have been nice. Oh, okay. Of course, Wayland has no real evidence either until now, as far as we know. We can only operate on the assumption that religion and history have otherwise unfolded identical to our own timeline. So I have to wonder, what has his relationship with God been like throughout his life? Was he raised in a religious family? He had to have been. That's the only scenario that works. Maybe little Peter wasn't so different from little Elizabeth asking, "Where do we go when we die?" Perhaps that's why he admires her faith. If he is raised as an atheist, then it's much harder to imagine some scenario that not only makes Wayland believe in God, but hate him. Perhaps, and this is hinted at in Covenant, he refuses to accept that this is merely the byproduct of random circumstance. So in a way, this is what he chooses to believe. He is an intelligent and rational man, but he is disappointed by the randomness and meaninglessness of the universe, at least from his perspective. So he rejects that reality and substitutes his own. And by gosh, he turned out right. Though there are many highly educated people who are also religious, I don't think we have ever seen anyone accomplish so much, become so intelligent, that they seek out God just so he can defeat him. But I'll be damned if that's not the most Peter Whalen thing I have ever heard. We'll come back to the whole immortality thing a little bit later when Vickers says a king has his reign, then dies, so I won't exhaust the topic here. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TravianDesigns, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. I would like to thank my patrons, Mark Boda and Tariq, and you should have the next episodes of Tron Legacy and Alien Covenant Movies by Minute episodes soon. And if you would like to become a Patreon supporter, head on over to patreon.com/traviandesigns.